Now, these load problems that you were talking about as it relates to the bear trap, did that come out of the Assiniboine trials?
That came out of sort of sitting at a desk and going over things and just checking what you... and looking at some of the trials. I think that what the trial showed us was that the rotors tilted. As the deck tilted, the rotor tilted, and therefore it was a big disc at an angle of attack to the wind. And therefore there must be some load on it, so we could not neglect it. And Sikorsky did the calculation for us, and also the National Research Council of Uplands. They had a Mr. McGregor, an aeronautical engineer, aerodynamicist, I believe, helicopter pilot, and so we went up. They were people that look at our problems or concerns or worries, and they both came up with about the same answer, so we said that must be right. So we fed those loads into the design requirements for the bear trap. So that was a big cost, and to some degree a delay, although we just didn't operate in bad weather with that.
Now, these additional loads that would have been placed on the rotors under certain wind conditions, that would have been for a very short period of time, would it not? Because once the helicopter had landed on the deck, the rotor blades were folded back. So this would have been during that particular sequence or during the takeoff sequence that these additional loads would be placed?
Yes, but you can't say how long that would be because you might start off the helicopter and it would take a while before the ship got turned into wind, or if it's for other operational considerations, might have to sit there for a while. The same after landing, because you want to, folding the blades is not a dead easy or safe in all wind conditions. But I don't think time's a factor. If the load is way up, you're going to do damage if you exceed it even for a fraction of a second.
So the concern was that damage would be done to the aircraft or that the bear trap would release?
Yeah, the loads would be greater than we had designed the bear trap for, particularly the vertical loads. And that the bear, in this case, it was the, when we checked it, it was the, what secured the bear trap to the trough, and we had to put some, what they call bars, which it engaged when it was in the landing position.
All right, so this would have been at deck level or slightly below deck level?
These on the 205 class were above deck level.
Above deck.
Yeah.
All right. You had raised something that I thought was pretty interesting before we turned on the tape. The actual shuttle or trough that the bear trap runs along the deck and into the hangar for traversing the aircraft in and out, that system seems to be very similar to a steam catapult aboard an aircraft carrier. Was that concept borrowed?
I believe so. When I was on Bonaventure, actually the ferry people came on board and they looked at what the shuttle trap, which is the shuttle that goes with the pistons, nothing to do with the pistons, but they looked at that. And I think they copied that, to what degree, I don't know, whether it was just the size and of it to... because I think they actually did use, because it leaves a slot in the decks, they actually used a rubber seal, a big long seal that seals a steam catapult trough. They used a section of that to seal the deck, the slot in the helicopter, in the DEH deck.
Right, okay. Just thought I'd raise that question. Now, one of the things that I came across doing the research was that during the early trials aboard Assiniboine, they had a constant problem with the breaking of cables.
That was a function of the control system I've talked about. In other words, the cable was good for about 6,000 pounds, I think, something like that. And for various reasons, one is they had a feature thing called landing bounce. Because when the helicopter lands, obviously there's a very sudden change in the speed of the cable. And unless the control system could respond quickly enough, you broke the cable or there was a shear pin that would let go. Now I'm trying to think of how the shear pin, yeah. But that was a darn nuisance.
Do you have any recollection of how many cables were actually snapped during the Assiniboine trials?
I don't. I have no recollection. I just know they had a lot. They had quite a few. I'm hazy now, but there was a shear pin on the end thing. Whether it was just a shear pin going and replacing. But even then, in the initial trials, it would be a nuisance because the pull-down cable was rolled through the trough back and forth, and you had to feed this thing up and down the trough to get it to the helicopter, to the bear trap. And that was modified by taking that out and making a hole under the trough and through the bear trap so that you actually reached through the bear trap down to the bottom of the trough and pulled the cable up.
Oh, I see.
Which means you had to release it before you moved the bear trap. But that was much simpler and much more reliable.
So without knowing what the cost of the cables were that kept snapping, one gets the impression that it was a very messy and time-consuming job to actually replace these cables.
It was. I think Peter Charlton explains that quite well in his book.
And so, obviously, DGA and BX-10 would have been working very closely with Doughty on this problem during the trials.
I forget how that was worked out, and because I forget, I think it was mostly worked out by the X-10.
Did you travel to the East Coast and have an opportunity to witness many of these trials firsthand?
I did firsthand to watch some of the trials. Most of my visits were to do with getting the ships ready. I know when Assiniboine first went there was a 3-week period where one of the spaces under the deck was a little office, and we were directing and supervising the installation day by day, and particularly as we did a sort of an impromptu perch chart to see which should go in where, when, and to because there was a very limited space in the winch compartment and under the deck and in the trough, so you couldn't have all the trades working at once. But it was critical that certain trades got in there first and then the rest could follow on. So that was where most of my work was done. Because the trials, VX-10 had the trials in hand. I didn't have to be there. It was quite good for my knowledge to be there.
Right.
But not for the progress of the trials.
One question that I have for you is, when you're talking about the actual haul-down cable and the tension that's put on that system, who would have been responsible for overseeing and dealing with the stresses that would have been placed upon the aircraft itself? Would that have been strictly VX-10's responsibility, or would there have been somebody on the staff of DGA that would have been looking after the aircraft side of the haul-down trial?
Yeah, VX-10 may have done it to a degree, but when it came to actually doing a stress analysis or checking on that, that would go back to United Aircraft. And they did some, and then some of it they went back to Sikorsky in Connecticut, who of course had done the original design and could look up the original reports and do that. But United Aircraft in Longueuil did a stress, a load analysis for us after the haul down. After we found it, worked out the rotor loads, and then they redesigned some of the main probe installation had to be redesigned because of changes there, both to the control and to the loads, and also the tail probe was redesigned the tail probe, particularly the tail probe tip, to provide a locking tip with a locking arrangement.
Now, as it relates to the aircraft itself, I remember reading that they had changed how the probe system was to work. Originally it was going to be with the aircraft itself, and then it was switched to the ship for the drop cable and the haul down and the probe, and they had done a reverse because of if the cable ever let loose under constant tension, it was particularly dangerous, not only to the aircraft, but anybody that might have been on the deck or the ship itself.
Yeah.
Is that something that you had a role to play in?
Well, probably part of it is because I didn't play a role in it, in looking at it closely initially. We just let in all fairness, go ahead and design it. But before it ever got to the ship, we looked at this probe, and which was supposed to be part of the end of the cable. It was supposed to be tied to the end of the cable and dropped when the aircraft went on. And it weighed about, it must have been 20 pounds. It was solid steel. And you can imagine what would happen if you released that on a tension on the cable, with all the energy in that, that it would obviously propel it back into the ship and do great damage, if not go through the deck. So that was obviously had to be changed very quickly.
So that's a modification as it relates to the aircraft. Was there also modifications as it related to the bear trap?
Well, as a result of that, the end of the fitting on the end of the haul down cable was changed. But that, I think, was the only change for the ship installation. The aircraft, of course, required extensive installation. They were a whole completely redesigned probe housing.
So did the Navy handle the fitting on the ship itself, but had to deal with Sikorsky for the
yeah, well,
probe?
We got Ferry to deal with the fitting on the ship, and the X-10 and Ferries dealt with the rearrangement of the probe housing, and United Aircraft then had to design the actual installation to fit in the aircraft.
All right.
In other words, they made sure that they take the loads and everything.
I have been told that that the RCN approached Sikorsky with some of these changes to the probe, and had drawn something up for Sikorsky and went to their engineers to see whether they thought that it was viable or feasible, and to be informed by Sikorsky at some later date that yes, indeed, the system would work. Do you have any recollection of that at all?
I don't. No, I don't have any recollection of that thing. I do have a recollection of talking to VX-10 and going over their sketches of how they thought it should work, and I'm hazy on how that was implemented. I think, obviously it had to be implemented by United Aircraft because they were responsible for the integrity of the probe housing and the whole design.
All right. Now, one of the other things that came out of the Assiniboine trials, and maybe you could speak to this, is the arrangement for the tail probe in order to straighten the aircraft so that it could be traversed into the hangar. Now that would have all been sort of part of the haul down project. What role did you play personally, or DGA play, in changing or modifying the original system?
DX-10 pointed out that it didn't work, the original system, which you're aware of what it is, because the fit would not stay in the deck grid. So it was then decided that United Aircraft would have to design a locking tip. So, and they did. They designed a tip that would have locks that would go out under the edges of a rails.
Would that be similar to like a harpoon or a fish hook? Or
a little bit of a harpoon feature. What it did was, it would land, and if it landed on the tip, it would, the lock would stay in. But if the tip dropped through the slot, the lock would come out. The part was that how do you get it engaged when it's behind and there is a fishtail? You're familiar with the fishtail arrangement, that it had to land in that and then find its way into the rail under however it happened to land. And for that, there was a fishtail ramp designed. And that was designed so that however it was pulled in that way, without having to set anything, it would lock. And when that was built properly, built to the drawings, it worked very well.
Now, did the aircraft center itself as it was being traversed into the hangar, or was it centered first and then traversed into the hangar?
It's centered first. In other words, because the probe is behind the wheels, you can't push it straight away, otherwise it'll just cock around. It's like, So it had to be pulled backwards, and in that sense, it sort of trailed to straighten out, and that's why the fishtail's behind there. You had to pull it backwards to straighten it enough to get into that fishtail, and then there was enough flexibility in the tires to allow it to the ramp of the fishtail to pull it into the center.
All right.
As you went forward, and then you could go forward. But the tail, you needed the tail probe sliding down the dead center spot to keep it straight.
All right. One of the other things, and I'm not too sure about this, but I assume that it would have been something that would have come out during the trials, and it's all sort of part of the haul down system. The pilot, or the LSO, or both, had to be able to disengage the aircraft from the haul down for whatever reason. And that was, from what I understand, could be accomplished by using an explosive charge, and that the aircraft could then fly away from the deck. Was there any trials with the explosive charge to see how well that system actually worked to disengage the aircraft from the haul down cable?
I don't recall any, but the explosive charge was a last resort. I mean, it was a bit like a rescue helicopter has a winch with an explosive charge in it. And that's only as to save the helicopter if things go wrong. There was a separate release which was used any time. There was a button there, and a lock was released hydraulically, I believe, in the probe housing in the helicopter, and that was the normal release.
So that button would have, I assume, both been in the aircraft, and would the LSO have a button?
No, the LSO had no button. I've got to be careful. The aircraft had the messenger cable. And I don't recall the explosive release on the helicopter. That's why I really shouldn't talk about that.
All right.
I don't have a picture. I do have something here. I can check out.
All right. We'll just stop the tape for a moment then. So you don't have any recollection of an explosive charge for the pilot in order to disengage from the haul down operation, but there are other systems built in, and perhaps you could speak about those.
The main one is that if you could not release the cable in an emergency, there was a shear pin which would go at 6,000 pounds. The maximum operational tension was 4,000 pounds. So that was a safety device at the time. Now, there may have been modifications since my time, but I don't recall. There was no, on the sketches I have, there's no explosive device on the helicopter probe housing.
All right. The shear pin rated at 6,000 pounds, was that something that happened automatically if you hit that
yes,
tension?
Yes, the load always went through that, and it was just it would just break if you went over that.
All right.
That was its purpose.
Now, what was the sort of normal haul down tension that was placed on the aircraft? Was that, I've seen figures from sort of 3,000 to 4,500 pounds per square inch. Would that be accurate?
Well, it would be pounds tension.
Pounds
absolute,
tension.
Absolute pounds tension on the cable. It was under the control of the LSO. He had control up to 4,000. He did not have the ability to go over 4,000. On his control console, he had a handle, and he could control it in between. In that, now as operations develop, I don't know what they use normally, but the thought was that in the worst conditions, to get a rapid haul down, initially the pilot was not going to do anything because he was just trying to keep level and keep the helicopter steady.
Right.
The tension was meant to, as the ship moved, to more or less keep the helicopter roughly in the center of the bear trap movement, and so that as the ship lull developed, it would be in a position to be pulled down. So the tension during the hover would probably be 3,000 or less, just enough to do that job. When the landing time came, it was going to go up to 4,000, and the extra tension was going to draw the helicopter probe into the bear trap. In practice, I believe the pilot can respond by lowering the collector slightly. Now, you have to talk to the operators. That should be as to what the current practice is.
All right. Now, you said that the LSO could not increase tension beyond 4,000 pounds tension. The shear pin would come into operation at 6,000.
Yes.
Was the system just designed that way, that that no more than 4,000 pounds tension was required in order for the haul down to actually take place?
It was not controllable above 4,000. The rope accumulator, what they call it, really was collapsed at a little bit above 4,000. At 4,000, there could be some variations due to inputs as a control system need a little bit of space to respond to a change of speed.
All right.
Induced by the helicopter changing its speed. But it's essentially bottomed out, and so there's no real tension control above 4,000.
Do you, or can you speak about whether going over 4,000 pounds would also have a negative impact upon the aircraft in terms of stress upon the airframe itself? Was that a consideration, or was it just strictly the rope accumulator that was the problem?
The rope accumulator. The probe was would have to take a far higher vertical load than the bear trap. So that whole structure was made for a far greater load. So 6,000 pounds was nothing in terms of structure. It was obviously quite a tension on the helicopter. It was not meant to be. It was just if the control system broke down at the winches, you lost control and they started reeling in madly, that there would be sort of a sudden jerk and the shear pin was popping. The helicopter would be back to square one.
Right. Now, two questions. Were there not some problems that came out of the trials? Is it related to the rope accumulator?
No, I can't remember. The design of the rope accumulator, I was involved in choosing the sizes and pressures of the rope accumulator on that. There were a couple. One was what they call the initial snatch. In other words, the messenger cable drew the winch cable up. It had the previous settings laid out on deck, a length of it, and the messenger cable drew up this slack cable with the end fitting on it and locked it into the helicopter as with slack cable. You then had to start the winch and draw in the slack. So a feature was added to the rope accumulator that when it was fully extended with slack cable, it was 2 foot per second switch. So at the maximum speed is 2 feet per second. So this would take up this cable in an acceptable fashion. And then, of course, as soon as it got tension on it, it would lift the accumulator and it would be in the, under the control of the LSO as far as the tension goes. That was the first one. And the second one was really a control one, which was the landing bounce. And what it amounted to was that if you landed 4,000, if the control system couldn't respond, the tension collapsed the rope accumulator with the speed of the winch, and the shear pin went. But that was a control problem. So both were modifications. Rope accumulator problems were, I don't recall, major ones.
If there was a problem and you reached that 6,000 pounds tension and the shear pin let go and you had to start from square one again for the hookup, how much work was involved in order to deal with that situation with the shear pin being let go? Was there any sort of maintenance that would be required prior to the hookup?
Mm-hmm. Well, you would have to get a new probe tip. The helicopter would have to jettison the end fitting, which would still be locked in there, and the ship would have to fit a spare shear pin in that. I think that's the sort of thing that would be done in a couple of minutes.
In a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
So that would probably be done while the helicopter was...
Yeah, I think the question then is why did the shear pin go?
Mm-hmm.
And that might be, that's a far more important consideration,
right,
not to just do the same thing again.
So... hypothetically, the aircraft, depending upon what the specific problem was, the aircraft might not be able to land back aboard.
It might not be able to land with a bear trap. It has been possible with care, depending on pilot skill and LSO, to land without the haul down cable from the bear trap. That has been done.
The free deck landing.
A free deck. Well, with a bear trap. I mean, free deck landing was with the bear trap in the hangar, I guess.
Right.
But to land that, no, I'm not up on that. I understand it has been done.
That would present all sorts of problems, too, because without the bear trap, the aircraft...
Well, yeah, well, with the bear trap, without the haul down.
Oh, I see.
With the bear trap, once you're trapped, and you don't need the haul down cable anymore. So it's a matter of being able to land the aircraft accurately enough.
That would take some exceptional flying skills, I would assume, because the bear trap is not a very big device sitting on the deck. And from what I understand, at some point in the operation, the pilot loses sight of the bear trap anyhow, because it's actually underneath the fuselage of the aircraft.
Yes.
So a lot of...
The LSO is in constant touch with him, and they also... that's an area I really don't know. Anyway,
I have to talk to an LSO or a pilot.
A pilot, yes. I'm always fascinated by their skill in doing this, and so what's great skill and what's dead easy for them, I not to judge.
Now, earlier you said that you had had an opportunity to witness firsthand the trials. Were these the local trials that you would have seen in either in Bedford Basin or in local waters off of Halifax?
Yes, I had witnessed trials there, more or less to get an idea of the initial work and some familiarization with it. Certainly, you know, the trials were conducted by VX-10, and I came over just to see and become familiar with it.
Do you recall any mishaps or mechanical problems during your visits? That presented problems from an engineering perspective?
Not during my visits. Usually the problems would be found beforehand, and it was more or less to verify the solution, or to sometimes it would all be worked out by the VX-10, was more or less to come down and put a stamp on it so that people in Ottawa felt that they were still in control.
I understand that VX-10 had a lot of latitude as it related to the project. They could get whatever they wanted done in relatively short order and often informally.
Well, they certainly had a knowledge of the situation and what needed to be done. Their limitations were on the money that ferries that was in the project, and also if the contractor needed direction. But I had enough confidence in VX-10 that if they would send a message to Ottawa and say, this is what we want done, and we would, within the terms of contract, send it to ferries to do it. Now, very often, we didn't have the money approved to do it, and so ferries, we really lost control at that point, because then ferries would respond directly to VX-10. Ferry Canada, we were hoping to sell it overseas. You see, we were far ahead of a lot of other countries at that time.
Particularly the British and the Americans.
Particularly the British and Americans, but the Japanese and others were interested too, and they were looking at, you know, profitable overseas orders, so they were prepared to put some of their own money into it. Not officially, but they certainly advanced the funded the project ahead of what TND did.
Right. How would you characterize the relationship between the RCN and ferry specifically?
I think at the technical level with Deering Martin, great. I think Peter Charlton tells how Jerry went to sea and designed part of the mountings for the rope accumulators at sea with us.
Right.
And that was the sort of cooperation that, and him and some of the other fellows at VX-10 actually worked on it. But there was always a problem because of the money in the contract side. We are sort of beggars at the door. And things like that. And when it came to meeting the specifications contractually, in other words, the sort of legalistic side, we were sort of at each other on that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Could you speak a little bit about Mr. Jerry Martin with Ferry Aviation? Do you know anything about his background or training?
Jerry Martin, the design and stressing of the bear trap and other things, was his forte, his background. And I think he'd come out of Avro, out of the Avro team disbanded. He had been in Avro anyway, whether it was on that or not. He was from Ireland, so I think he came out of the British aircraft industry initially with by training and that. But a delightful gentleman. We enjoyed working with him very much.
Just sort of a sidetrack here for a moment, if we can. Did you have any recollection of a corporation called Genair in the mid-50s, a little bit before your time with the DGA? There was a company called Genair that was going after a contract with the RCN for a haul-down system for the Canadian Navy. And they were one of the key players at that time, but don't hear very much about them after 1955-56. And I'm just wondering.
Before my time, the U.S. Navy had a constant tension system for a drone landing.
Right.
They're going to do all this by drones, unmanned helicopters. And we looked into that a bit. Now, I'm not sure whether that was, Genair was contracted for that system, but we were not impressed with it, and we didn't look further. In fact, we didn't get anything very useful out of that, as I can recall.
Similarly, the RCN was not very impressed with the harpoon and grid system that the RN was exploring.
Yeah. Going back to the USN system, I think that kept them away from the Paul Down.